you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. If you're into the science of longevity, or as it's sometimes called in popular media science, anti-aging, you're going to love this interview. And because it's a lot to digest, I decided to split it into two. So the first part of the series will come out today, and then the second part, which will be an in-depth exploration of the latest molecules and compounds, or as our guest calls them, molecular agents. Stay tuned for our episode next week as well. But today, we're focusing on our guest's tenets of aging, her blood sugar management protocol, and why she microdoses over 70 different ingredients. Sharing this with us is Dr. Sandra Kaufman. Sandra began her academic career in the field of cellular biology, earning a master's degree from the University of Connecticut in tropical ecology and plant physiology. Then she turned to medicine, and the rest is history. In the longevity realm, she's known as the author and creator of the Kaufman Protocol, a systematic explanation of why we age on a cellular basis, coupled with an organized system to delay the aging process. The theory was introduced in her book, The Kaufman Protocol, Why We Age and How to Stop It, which has been recognized by many longevity leaders as a go-to for understanding the aging process. More recently, she wrote The Kaufman Protocol, Aging Solutions. Thus, she is well respected in the longevity community for presenting viable and scientifically based aging solutions that are available to everyone. She appears on weekly podcasts around the world, sits on longevity boards, and has spoken at innumerable health and biohacking seminars. We'll discuss more of her backstory in the episode itself. You can find the links and the show notes to this one at mindbodypeak.com/74. And if you enjoy this kind of thing, it really helps me and the show out if you leave this a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you downloaded this. That is also how I continue to bring you thought-provoking guests. Okay, on to the episode with Dr. Sandy Kaufman. Sandy, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This one has been, 4 or 5 months in the making, so I'm looking forward to discussing the science of longevity and what you've been working on recently for your new book.
Yeah, so this is quite exciting. The last book was been out maybe, 3 years ago, and I immediately plunged into new ideas because they keep coming at us sort of in an exponential manner. So the new book explores a whole lot of really cool things, and I think they're exciting.
Yeah, and we'll get into all that in 1 second, but we'll start off by warming up with the unusuals or non-negotiables you've done so far today for your health and performance.
The unusuals? Oh my gosh, here's an unusual thing that I've decided is now non-negotiable. And I don't mean this to sound like an ad for any company, but it's going to. I recently bought a Catalyst suit. Sort of electrifies you while you're exercising. 20 minutes on, and oh my God, you feel like you have been electrocuted, but your muscles are fantastic. And so it is now my brand new must-go-to exercise maneuver.
Mm. Is that more on the performance side to like stimulate muscle protein synthesis and growth, or is it more on the recovery side?
Oh no, it's definitely like the former. it recruits extra muscle as you are doing it. And you can control the degree of which you're getting electrified. When the company will shoot me and say, I'm using all the wrong terminology, but essentially it activates as many muscle groups as you want it to. So it's a very controlled system. and it is just exhausting. Oh my God. Takes a few days to recover, but it is just the most phenomenal thing I've experienced in a while.
And are you able to do like body weight workouts with it, or do you still use weights, or how's that work?
Oh no. Oh God, no. No. So for example, what's quite interesting is it activates your triceps and your biceps at the same time. So you're just basically forcing you're working against yourself. And the stronger you sort of turn up the power on this thing, the harder it is. So honestly, it is like being in a bath of thick, not very viscous goo, and you're just trying to. So like the idea of weights, oh my God, maybe once you get good at this, you would throw some in there, but I just can't see that being necessary.
Yeah. I wonder if you still get the same cardio metabolic benefits from this type of thing, like these modern technologies, the EMS. So they're called EMS suits.
Yeah.
As like a traditional strength training or resistance training.
You know what? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, clearly cardio. I still swim a ton. I still rock climb. I still do all of the other things. I think it's just a nice addition, you know?
Well, let's go on to your background. How did you get involved in this and interested in this world of longevity and human performance?
So excellent question. I was a cell biologist once upon a time. I used to travel through tropical jungles and then stare at plant cells and mitochondria. Actually, they don't have mitochondria. Chloroplasts and that sort of thing. That was kind of fun. I went to med school. I presently am an anesthesiologist. So I deal with dosing of medications, how medications affect your body, how your body affects medications, so on and so forth. But I'm also an avid rock climber. And I was dangling off a cliff in my mid-40s, and I'm like, unless I stop aging, this whole thing isn't going to work out very well. So I have dedicated the last 8 to 10 years to sort of unravel aging, sort of figure out what happens on a cellular level, and then figure out the best ways to sort of combat each and every one of the methods or the reasons that you go into cellular decline.
And that's where you started with your 2018 book, The Kaufman Protocol. And what did you change or add on to in your new book?
So what's kind of cool is the categories of aging. So I still have 7 tenets of aging, and it basically talks about each of these 7 ways that your cells get affected, right? So it's your DNA and your mitochondria and your pathways and that sort of thing. So that part hasn't changed, but the categories have become sort of more granular. So, for example, in the DNA category, on top of epigenetics and telomeres, I like to think about DNA protection, DNA stability, for example. In mitochondria, we used to just think about NAD deficiency and free radicals. And now I've discovered my new favorite pore. And, you know, God knows who needs a favorite pore, right? But it's the mitochondrial permeability transition pore. And it's a pore that sits on the wall of the mitochondria. And it just sort of opens and closes when you're young. It flickers. And as you get older, it opens up dramatically, and it can just sort of destroy your mitochondria and your cells. So controlling that's important. So, I mean, I guess it just is in each category, there's just more detail. And that's sort of what's important.
I see. And I know I've heard from other people in my own research, such as when I interviewed Ryan Smith of True Diagnostic and previously TaylorMade Compounding, that in their model, there's 9 tenets of aging. So how did you come up with the 7?
So actually, they said it was really funny. So Aubrey de Grey, once upon a time, birthed the idea of the 9 hallmarks of aging. When I started down this road, I didn't know who Aubrey de Grey was. I mean, I read the article, but I'm like, you know, it's a good idea, whatever. And I did all of this on my own without sort of any pre-understanding or pre-decisions from other people's research. So I sat there with a ton of post-it notes and a billion theories, and I thought they fit really nicely into 7 categories. People are like, oh, that's not respectful of the past. I don't really give a rat's ass. I think it just makes a ton of sense to do it in 7 tenets. Mm-hmm. And it's roughly the same stuff. It's just sort of, I think, a just different categorization scheme. And I also like to think that, you know, people can remember 7 things. Who remembers 9? 9's tough, right? But we all have had 7-digit phone numbers because people can remember 7 things. So yeah, I think it makes it a little easier.
Well, that's a good segue into, can you describe what those are in a little bit of detail? Not too much, because that would take the whole episode.
Yeah, sure. So briefly, tenet one is what happens to your DNA. So it's DNA alterations over time. In this category, we have telomeres. Telomeres, of course, get shorter with each cellular replication. This is made worse by stress and that sort of thing. So that is part of this. We also talk about epigenetic modifications. We know that epigenetics change over the course of time based on, there's some changes that are pretty much standard. And then there's epigenetic drift, things that we can sort of control better with our diet and our habits and such. And then there's DNA stability. We need to protect our DNA from the outside harsh world. And I think that now there's cool things that can do that. So that's essentially tenet one. Tenet two, you need an energy source for your cells. So that's mitochondria. As I alluded to before, most people over the age of 40 have a nicotinamide deficiency or an NAD deficiency, rather. I should be more specific. So that's a low-hanging fruit. We also talk about free radical damage. Your ability to make endogenous free radical scavengers over the course of time falls. So then, of course, you have more free radical damage from both oxygen and nitrogen species. And of course, there's the mitochondrial transport port that I just talked about. And then, of course, you know, there are other things that happen to your mitochondria. You get coenzyme Q deficiencies and then a variety of other things. So that category is, but it all falls into the mitochondrial category.
Yeah.
So three is pathways. And you can argue that there's probably, you know, 100 different longevity pathways, but I like the big three. We talk about sirtuins, we talk about the AMP kinase pathway, and then, of course, we talk about the mTOR pathway. And sort of new in my world is everyone was focused on sirtuin-1 because it's sort of the homeostatic way of controlling most of the cellular activities. But I've recently been obsessed with sirtuin-3. And that sounds rather random, but I'll explain it. So there's seven mammalian sirtuins. One is in your nucleus. Two sort of floats around your cell and it's in and out of the nucleus. Three, four, and five live in your mitochondria. And then six and seven are back in the nucleus. And it turns out that three is sort of the keystone moderator of mitochondrial activity. And it's been shown that increasing sirtuin-3 is really the only one that can actually positively affect human lifespan, like not in theory, but like in actuality. And the way it works is sirtuin-3 controls 84 mitochondrial proteins. So when that fails over time, your mitochondria don't work, your energy source fails, and then, of course, you know, you've got tissue failure. So again, sirtuin-3 is my new obsession, and six is pretty damn important as well. The other ones, not so much. But that's the land of pathways. Tenet four is what I call quality control. There are DNA repair mechanisms and protein repair mechanisms, and of course, autophagy. I have gone down the road of what cool DNA repair mechanisms can we find. In this category, it's kind of cool. There's four or five, depending on how you count them. But there's something called the BER. So I don't want to be too detailed, but it turns out that there are two plants in the tropics that can actually increase the repair of your DNA from sunlight, which is actually amazingly cool because over the course of time, UV radiation sort of melts your DNA together into something called CPDs, or they're dimers, essentially two base pairs get melted together. This happens in plants as it happens in us, and the plants have figured out how to deal with it. And so we get to steal their compounds and help ourselves. So that's kind of cool. Protein repair mechanisms, of course, this is where proteostasis all comes in and the UPS system. And you can upregulate chaperones, you know, the heat shock proteins, the cold shock proteins, and that sort of thing. So that's where that is. And there's a new emphasis on autophagy because we didn't really have any good autophagy moderators before. And now we do. So that's sort of more key. Let's see, where are we? Five. Tenet five is inflammatory issues. Of course, your immune system does two key things. So number one, it fights infection. And number two, it gets rid of your own cells that have gone rogue. Mm-hmm. So any virus-infected cells or senescent cells or cancerous cells, those generally are eradicated by your immune system. Of course, it fails over time. So you have an increased risk of all of these things, right? Increased senescent cells, increased cancer cells, and increased risk of infection. So that's something that we worry about in tenet five. Tenet six is individual cell requirements. So this is the idea that not all cells are the same. We want to get rid of our senescent cells. We want to optimize our stem cells. And then it's the recognition of a bone cell needs different things than a brain cell or a liver cell, that sort of thing. And then lastly is waste management. which is mostly glycation. And I'm sort of obsessed with this lately. I developed a 7-step mechanism of getting rid of the problems with glycation, or not necessarily getting rid, but blocking sugar pathways and AGE pathways and that sort of thing. And then, of course, the accumulation of lipofuscin in cells also falls into the waste management category. In a nutshell, a very large nutshell, are the 7 tenets of aging and a few of the updates.
Wow. There's a lot there, and we can take this in a bunch of different directions. But is that how you designed your like biochemical agent directory? You created like a really cool rating system where you broke down each of the different popular or not so popular longevity ingredients, and you gave them different ratings. And is that how you are approaching modulating each of those pathways or improving each of those pathways?
Oh, 100%. So when I started, of course, the system I thought was going to be fairly easy. There's 7 categories and each category gets a number. And for people that are not familiar with this, so we'll just pretend that agent X is something that you're interested in, like whatever it is. And if extensive research demonstrates that it does absolutely nothing, it gets a 0 in that category. If there's test tube or theoretical or culture evidence, it gets a 1. If there's significant evidence in models of rodents and other mammals that are not humans, it gets a 2. And it's not one mouse study. Like, it has to be significant. It gets a 2. And then human studies, if there's some, you know, demonstrations that it's efficacious, it gets a 3. So every agent now comes with a 7-digit rating number. Someday I envision like kind of there being a barcode, which would be kind of cool. The difference now is, and I don't really make a big deal out of it, but at some point it's going to become more granular, right? Instead of just tenet one, it'll be like tenet 1.A, right? Because there's just more and more and more information, and people think, oh, I've got enough points in category one. Well, maybe you're like doing fantastic stuff for your epigenetics, but maybe you also need to do something for your DNA support system. So at the moment, it's still sort of simplified, but I think that I'm going down the road of sort of like more specific specifications.
There's 2 places I want to touch on a little more in depth, and that was the CERT3 activation and what exactly we can do to increase that, because it sounds very interesting and I'm always a fan of mitochondria-centered medicine. And then also after that, the AGE sugar glycation blocking process that you come up with.
Sure. So CERT3 is really, really quite interesting. So honeycoil from magnolia turns out to be the rock star in this category, the absolute rock star. And I think I didn't really appreciate what it did. I'm like, it's free radical scavenger. So are 20,000 other things. But when I sort of stumbled upon this, I thought this is truly amazing. Then of course the bioavailability of the agent is truly terrible, as they all are. And then I stumbled upon one company in Amsterdam that makes liposomal honeycoil. I was like, damn. So yeah. I just actually broke down and ordered a whole bunch of stuff from them. So I'm truly, truly sort of excited about that. And then there are a few other things that do it, but sort of to a lesser degree. So I am hoping, right, if we, because mitochondria are just, they're just crucial. And it's the lowest hanging fruit. If you don't have energy, none of your cells are going to work. So if you activate your CERT2 and 3, if you feed in enough, NAD precursors, and if you make sure everything else is working, you know, we could, theoretically, most of the tissues that have a lot of mitochondria, maybe we can just keep them going. And realizing that your crowd is probably young and not necessarily peri or postmenopausal, but the women's reproductive system is the lowest hanging fruit because it sort of fails first. I think that it fails, not entirely, but significantly because of mitochondrial failure, because it has a huge population of mitochondria. And a cell that's developing into an egg, it sort of revs up. It has like 500,000 mitochondria.
Wow.
If it can't do that, the cell fails, right? And that's the beginning of menopause. Interestingly enough, the retina has 500,000 as well. And then other tissues sort of have less. But it sort of explains why your vision goes and why your reproductive systems sort of go early. Anyway, so that's my mitochondrial spiel.
Yeah. Ryan Smith was also telling me about it. I think it's a metabolite of magnolia bark and it's called DHHP. I think that's what it's called. Are you familiar with that? Is it all similar?
Yeah. So what they're trying to do is they know that magnolia does it, right? And then they're trying to like figure out exactly what inside of that does it. And it's contributory. It's just not as potent as the honeycoil.
Yeah. I think he was saying it for sleep. It worked better for him, but I guess there's a lot of uses for it as well.
Oh, of course. Of course. Lots of these things have uses, right? So what's really kind of cool about sleep, everyone, it means something different to everybody. But in my world, lack of sleep is a failure of your circadian rhythms, right? And your circadian rhythms are driven by your sirtuins. There's two proteins that make you go to sleep, and there's two proteins that make you wake up. It's all driven by your sirtuins, right? And your sirtuins are nicotinamide deficient. I mean, are dependent, right? You need NAD as a cofactor to make your sirtuins work.
Yeah.
So honic oil and all of the things that help activate your sirtuins, not just three, but 1, 6, and 7 as well, will help you with sleep because, you know, they just do. They upregulate the proteins that control the circadian rhythms.
Let's go on now to the second part, and that's the tips, strategy, protocol you use to mitigate the damage of advanced glycation end products or too much sugar consumption.
Okay, so I have to tell you, this is sort of funny. I gave a lecture actually last week, and I crowdsourced it because I didn't know what to talk about. And like, you know, some, you know, gave people like 17 options, and I got so many emails, and by far everyone wanted to know how to deal with glucose. So I give this fantastic lecture because everyone knows I'm publicly on record as saying I eat a donut a day. And I do because it's fun and I love donuts. I probably shouldn't, but you know, if you can, you can. Why not? Anyway, so it's a 7-step process. And then you probably do other things, but sort of in a pseudo nutshell, the first thing you can do is you can block the breakdown of carbohydrates. Right. There's two enzymes in your gut. There's alpha amylase, which is in your salivary glands as well as in your pancreas. And it blocks huge carbohydrate or breaks big carbohydrates into smaller pieces, essentially. And then alpha glucosidase, which lives in your intestinal wall, breaks it into mono and disaccharides. Right. And then you absorb those. And the cool thing is that there are a lot of agents that block the breakdown of those enzymes. Thus, you know, the carbohydrates stay in your gut and you poop them out and then they don't get metabolized. I always tell people that you want to do this a little bit, but not a lot, because you will fart a lot. And it's really not very pleasant because your gut, like all the bugs in your gut go, oh my God, extra food. And then you just fart like a mad person. So it's kind of crazy. The big drug that does this is acarbose, but there are a variety of other natural agents that do it as well. There's a ton of them.
Yeah.
So that is option or step one. Step two, you can actually block. There's this a crucial enzyme in your liver that creates new glucose. It's called gluconeogenesis, and it also blocks the breakdown of glycogen, which is, whatever, doesn't matter. Long word. Anyway, chlorogenic acid from coffee blocks this enzyme, glucose 6-phosphate transferase. And so you're making less glucose, which is a good thing, right?
Yeah.
The other thing you can do is you can drive glucose into your cells more readily. Your cells have glucose receptors. They're, it's like, you know, if you see it in a article, it's going to be GLUT 1 through 13. GLUT 4 is the major one, and it drives glucose into fat cells and muscle cells. Generally speaking, if a cell does not need energy, it's going to downregulate this receptor. So if you're fat or lazy or muscle atrophy or denervation, et cetera, you're going to downregulate this receptor. Alternatively, if you exercise, you're going to upregulate the receptor because your cell is telling the rest of you, just says, hey, you know, I need some energy down here. You can artificially upregulate that receptor. So that's a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
The next trick, and this is kind of cool, is you can actually urinate more glucose. The kidney works by this neat mechanism whereby it filters out the glucose from your blood, takes out about 180 grams of glucose a day, and then it reabsorbs it, mostly 90% of it, back into your vasculature, right? You can block that receptor. The key, of course, is that you're going to urinate a ton of glucose, which can lead to some infections if you're not the cleanliest person in the world. But generally speaking, it's a pretty benign medication. So that's kind of cool. The next step, of course, is you can block AGE production, right? glucose in seven non-enzymatic steps becomes AGEs, which, we all know are very inflammatory and bad for you. Many ways to do this. First thing, and this is one of my favorites, glucose preferentially sticks to three specific amino acids on your proteins. It's lysine, arginine, and cysteine. And I don't know if that's important or not. But what's incredibly cool is you can actually, I call this my amino acid decoy system. If you flood your body with those specific amino acids, the glucose is going to preferentially bind to those over the protein or over the amino acids in your proteins that are like embedded in you. So you can actually decoy the glucose, stick it, and then urinate it out so that it sort of preserves your endogenous tissues. Isn't this fun? There's so many ways to cheat the system.
Yeah, I love that. Can you just use any amino acid supplement, or does it have to be those specific ones? You have to take a spoonful of each of those and mix it together like that?
Well, I mean, if you can take all of the amino acids, but these are the ones that it sticks to. They just preferentially do. Mm-hmm. Another cool thing you can do is there's a molecule called lactoferrin. And this is in milk, right? Lactoferrin carries iron. So generally speaking, it's breast milk that carries iron molecules.
Colostrum too.
Yes. Yes. But that's just what the word means, right? Lacto is milk. Anyway, but the cool thing about this, if you measured your own lactoferrin levels and they were high, it would indicate a high degree of inflammation, right? But what's cool is if you take exogenous lactoferrin, it does two things. So number one, it's actually the shutoff signal for an inflammatory process, right? So under normal circumstances, your body's going through the inflammatory process. At the end, it releases lactoferrin and everything gets shut down, which is why the levels say, okay, I'm highly inflamed. But if you take extra, it just shuts it off, sort of like without having to reach the high point of an inflammatory status. So that's kind of cool. Wow. But the other thing that it does is if you look at the lactoferrin molecule, it's sort of like a barbell shape sort of do. And it has two binding sites, one on each side. And instead of carrying iron, it can actually bind AGEs.
Oh.
So I call this my famous AGE sponge, right? If you take exogenous stuff, it flows around your body. It binds one molecule of lactoferrin to two molecules of AGEs and you excrete it and you're done. So that's kind of cool. Let's see. So many other processes. Let's get to the RAGEs, I guess. So there's a receptor for an AGE. It's called a RAGE. Most people know about that, right? And if an AGE hits one of these receptors on a cell, one of two things can happen. Either it gets brought into the cell and the AGE is destroyed, or it activates a huge systemic inflammatory process. Right. So that's a bad thing. But what's cool is that the top part of this receptor frequently can either one break off or two is made independently of the cell. They're called soluble RAGEs because they're floating around and they're not attached to the cell. Mm-hmm. It's cool, but they still have the receptor for the binding site for the AGE. So if a soluble RAGE is floating around in your vasculature and it attaches to an AGE, it doesn't activate anything and you just excrete it.
Oh.
So that's kind of cool. So there's lots of ways to activate that. The ECGC in green tea does it. Exercise does it. And one of my new favorite drugs, pioglitazone, can do it. And while I've mentioned pioglitazone, this is cool too, because it is an old-fashioned drug that lowers blood glucose levels. It is an activator of your mitochondria. It activates this fantastic enzyme. It's the master switch for mitochondria. It's the PCG1 alpha enzyme. So it turns everything on. So that's cool. And the other thing that pioglitazone does is it takes your visceral fat, like the stuff that's in your belly that's really bad for you, and it reallocates it and it sticks it in your subcutaneous tissues. So when you're young and you have a lot of subcutaneous fat and you look very healthy and such, that's fantastic. As you get older, you lose your subcutaneous fat. Like a young person's like, I don't want fat anywhere. But as you get older, you need subcutaneous fat. So this drug actually takes it from where you don't want it, sticks it where you do want it. So that is just like a win-win, in my opinion. Anyway, so I don't know if I covered all seven, but that's a pretty damn good start on how to deal with your glycosylation problems.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And how do you know if you're effective? Like, can you measure your glucose pre-meal and post-meal and figure out if it's working, or will you see it not see it on a CGM, for example?
You should see it. I mean, some people are into the constant glucose monitoring. You can absolutely, I've heard that you can see it on that. Clearly you could follow it in your, you know, your hemoglobin A1C, which is a 3-month track going backwards. It's actually, here's a quite a bit of a funny story. I recently decided to apply to NASA, just for fun, for a whim. And they said, okay, you have to, you know, send us some labs. So I did, but I forgot that I was taking these drugs to excrete more, glucose. So when I got the results back, my jaw hit the floor. I entirely forgot. And I looked like a dying diabetic alcoholic. I was like, oh, I'm in trouble. So clearly I did not send that lab in. I stalled. I waited 6 days, cleared my system, had a normal one and sent it in. But it was just like, it was like this absolute reminder that, oh yeah, this stuff works.
Mm-hmm. And then also you mentioned that's all about glycation and the sugar side. But if you're eating a donut a day, are you worried about the fats within that donut?
Oh, I've got a whole 7-step process for fats too.
Oh, it's a whole nother process.
Oh, it's a whole nother process. Absolutely.
Is there like a simple version of it?
No, not really. No, it's really significantly more complicated because it depends on what all of your blood levels are to start with.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's that one's a bit more complicated. We could do an entire show on that and maybe we'll do that 6 months from now.
Yeah. Are you a fan of any of like the typical recommendations of helping with that, say like vitamin E or chlorella or glycine in certain amounts?
You know, everything has its helpfulness. E is kind of crappy. Everyone talks about E. I think it's a free radical scavenger. It does some good things. I don't think you want to be deficient necessarily, but taking extra isn't going to necessarily be beneficial. There's stuff that is way better. I mean, astaxanthin is way better. Delphinidin is way better. So that's not necessarily the answer. I do like chlorella, but I think I use things that are like way more potent. Anyway, there's many ways to skin a cat. So I'm not going to say that one thing is completely terrible. I just have my favorites.
Mm-hmm. And when you're creating your rating system, how do you make sure that these things you're taking that are way more potent aren't also going to have significantly more risks or long-term side effects that maybe we don't know quite yet, but in 5 years or so, 10 years, there'll be a lot more data around them?
So that's an excellent question. Most of the stuff that I take has been around for 3,000-4,000 years.
Wow.
Right. So granted, a lot of them are medications and we don't know, but we do, they're, you know, they're all been cleared through the FDA, which granted isn't necessarily like, you know, the absolute, you know, approval that nothing bad's going to happen. But a lot of these drugs have been around for a very long time. And a lot of these supplements have been around for an extraordinarily long time. And clearly we kind of know what the side effects are. To sort of address that, I sort of have the strategy of micro dosing. I take 72 plus or minus things a day. And every time I read a study, it demonstrates that there's, you know, synergism between all of the different pathways. So I don't think it's absolutely necessary to take a full dose of absolutely everything, you know, every day. So at that point, I think that I'm increasing the efficacy while decreasing the side effect profile. And so far, so good. I don't necessarily know if I'm going to be harming myself in 5 to 10 years. On the other hand, all of my studies seem to point in the direction that everything's fine, with the exception of my crazy urine. Yeah, it's a small detail.
Uh-huh.
But so it was reversible. So, it's, you know, 6 days off, it was totally fine.
Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, like, I guess maybe because the levels are so low, you're not as worried about negative interactions between the 70 plus different things you're taking every day?
Oh, no, that's exactly right. You know, and I don't actually, you know, I don't suggest that people necessarily take 72 things a day. But as you know, I do a lot of intricate research on this stuff. And remember, I'm an anesthesiologist. This is what I do for a living.
Yeah.
I look at drugs and drug interactions and methods of metabolism. And, you know, this is what I do. So I'm fairly confident that I'm pretty darn safe. And I can tell you that my liver enzymes are fine. My kidney enzymes are fine, or my clearance rates. Everything seems to be absolutely fine. You know, every now and then I'll kind of screw up and I take a variety of diabetic drugs for fun because I'm not diabetic, but I take them anyway. And then, you know, I try to fast and then I forget that I've done this and then my blood sugar plummets and I'm like, yeah, that was a bad idea. So, you know, everything sort of has to be done with a grain of salt and with a, you know, a whiff of knowledge.
When you're taking that shotgun approach where you're taking a bunch of different things in smaller doses, do you still cycle the different compounds? Because like certain things you want to take a week on and a week off, something like that. And is it as necessary if you're microdosing it?
So it is. And this is why I talk about the difference between an adjuvant and a supplement, right? Most people, they're like, oh, everything's a supplement. And it's not. Well, at least in my definition, it's not, right? So I like to think that something that you have endogenously in your body, if you're giving more of that, that's a supplement. You're supplementing your endogenous levels, right? So the good example I always use is carnosine. Everyone has carnosine in their bodies. If you take more, it's a supplement. Astaxanthin, my other favorite example. None of us endogenously make astaxanthin. It comes from algae. Yeah. So if we take it, it's an adjuvant. And the reason I make this distinction is because supplements have feedback loops and adjuvants do not, for the most part, right? Depends on sort of like how they're affecting cycles. Yeah. So carnosine, the more carnosine you take, you activate an enzyme called carnosine ACE. And it is the enzyme that your body uses to break down carnosine. So the more carnosine you take, the more enzyme you make to break it down. And you've got the escalating war of like make it or, take it, break it down, take it, break it down. So I absolutely cycle that one because I want my, the enzymes that get rid of it to go down and then I can start taking it again, right? So things that are supplements, I tend to cycle. Things that are adjuvants, I tend not to. Mm-hmm. And I also have, I've separated my piles into stuff at home that's absolutely mandatory every day and then stuff that I just take during the week. And I sort of mandate this by leaving one in the office and one at home so that it just sort of stays in piles. So some of it, it's 5 days on, 2 days off, and other stuff it's every day because I think it's crucial.
I see. That's a good way of dividing them too, and like having your pile at home and your pile at the office, and also separating supplements and adjuvants. Yeah, that way it's a more clear, distinct, easy to follow like routine for folks.
People are going to be like, oh my God, this is a lot of work. And the answer is once you order something in the mail, it comes in, you're like, aha, it's a this or that. You just carry it to that place and then you don't have to think about it again. So it's not something that you have to obsess over every day. It's a one-time decision that it's done.
Do you like bulk prep them so that you're not taking like opening 70 different bottles every single day and pouring out one capsule or one scoop of powder?
So I go with a half and half theory. So my pile at home actually sits in the bottles, which is not a big deal. And one of the reasons I do that is less of my family sort of takes them too. So I just leave the bottles sitting there. My pile at work, I have what I call my stacks. And so it's these little tiny containers that attach to each other. They're cute little round things. And so every 2 weeks, I separate them all out so that when, if anyone walks into my office, I don't look like a strange drug addict. All they will see is a little tiny cup of, 30 some, little capsules. It's simply because I don't want people to think I'm completely crazy and it's a time-saving maneuver. I'm not a big powder person. I find that just revolting and disgusting. So I'm more of a capsule person. But, everyone has their own way of doing things.
But what about, are you able to find capsules that are low enough dose to fit your criteria?
Oh, absolutely. Because generally speaking, if you read any bottle, right, it says take two or four. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm taking one.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually been doing that with spermidine. And I've been microdosing it. I'm young, so I don't think it's as necessary for me to supplement, but I like that approach of microdosing a bunch of different things and going that route instead.
Well, it's also sort of it's similar to your diet, right?
Yes.
You're not going to eat 17 piles of broccoli every day, right? No. But if you eat, if you eat a piece of broccoli and a piece of this and a piece of that, covers your micronutrients and it sort of covers all of the aspects of aging without being a complete nut.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I want to talk more about specific agents and the ones that you brought to forefront and maybe even limelight in the longevity community. But this meeting is about to end, so we will resume this in 1 minute. How does that sound?
Perfect.
And that is it for part one, folks. If you found this interesting, you'll certainly want to tune in next week for the continuation, where we break down the crucial ingredients that Sandy discovered in her own research and she personally takes on a regular basis. All right, see you next week. Thank you for tuning in to this episode.
head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/ and then the number of the episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.